Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Okay, let's talk about the Southern Caucasus. If you picture it geographically, it's this incredible ancient land bridge, right?
Absolutely. It connects Western Asia, these huge cultural centers in Anatolia and Iran, with the Eurasian steppe stretching out to the north.
Yeah, and for something like 5,000 years, it's just been this constant stage for, well, everything. Conflict, trade, migrations, empires clashing.
A real melting pot, historically speaking.
So that brings up a big question. How much chaos, you know, how many invasions or shifts in power does it actually take to completely change the genetic makeup of a population living there?
That's exactly what this new research digs into. And honestly, the answer they found is pretty stunning.
How so?
Well, despite all that upheaval you mentioned, think Romans versus Sassanids, wave after wave of nomadic groups like the Alans, the Huns, the core genetic heritage of the people in the Southern Caucasus showed this remarkable continuity.
So they weren't just replaced by newcomers?
Not wholesale, no. They definitely absorbed influences, sometimes quite dramatically, but the underlying genetic foundation, it seems, remained largely intact. It wasn't overwritten.
The genetic backbone held strong. Okay, that resilience is fascinating. We need to explore that. But first, you mentioned something truly striking the researchers investigated, this practice of artificial cranial deformation, ACD.
Ah, yes, ACD. It's quite visceral when you first encounter it.
What is it exactly?
It's the practice of intentionally shaping an infant's skull as it grows, usually by binding it tightly.
To make it elongated.
Exactly, to achieve this distinct elongated shape. It's a very visible lifelong modification, and culturally it's quite shocking. Historical sources suggest it arrived in the Caucasus mainly with groups from outside the region, particularly nomadic peoples.
Like the Sarmatians, maybe?
Sarmatians, yes, and later groups associated with the Huns as well. So you have this very dramatic cultural marker showing up, clearly linked to migrants.
Which creates a puzzle, right? How does a population adopt something so visually striking, so foreign, without undergoing a massive genetic shift itself? If the locals started doing it, what does that mean?
Precisely. How did they absorb this practice without being genetically replaced? And that's where this study is so clever, linking the genetics directly to the individuals buried with these modified skulls.
So that's our goal for this deep dive then, to trace these 5 millennia of history in the Caucasus, looking at both the genetic resilience and these fascinating cultural adaptations.
And before we dive deeper, we really should acknowledge the huge effort behind this. We're celebrating the work primarily from the Department of Archaeogenetics at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology.
Right, and their key collaborators too.
Absolutely. Crucial partners like the Ivan Javakashvili Institute of History and Ethnology in Tbilisi and several others. It's their combined work that's really pushed forward our understanding of how genetics, culture, and mobility intertwined in this vital region.
Okay, setting the scene a bit more. The Caucasus wasn't just a transit zone, was it? It was important in its own right.
Definitely. It was a major center for cultural and technological innovation throughout history. It served as this isthmus, like you said, connecting the Near East and the steppe.
Even with the huge mountains, the greater Caucasus range sort of dividing north and south.
Right. Even with those barriers, think back to the early Bronze Age. You had the Kura-Araxes culture.
Mm-hmm, that's the farming culture.
Yes. Sedentary farmers, basically connecting eastern Anatolia and northwestern Iran. Later on, things shifted. Mobile pastoralism became more common, trade networks expanded, metallurgy took off, and you see the rise of these significant ancient kingdoms.
Right, Colchis, famous from Greek myths.
Exactly. Colchis in western Georgia and the Kingdom of Iberia in the east. These were major players.
So, scientifically speaking, what was the gap in our knowledge that this study aimed to fill?
Well, we actually had a pretty decent genetic picture for the earlier periods, like the Neolithic and the Ineolithic, the Copper Age. Those studies confirmed early movements of people.
Okay.
But the period after that, say from the Bronze Age collapse around 3500 BCE, right up through the migration period around 700 CE, that whole stretch of roughly 4,000 years, it was much less understood, especially for Georgia.
And that's a period of huge historical drama, isn't it?
Immense drama. You've got intense social changes, the rise of elites, these massive empires like Rome and the Sassanid Persians constantly fighting over the region, plus continued interactions with nomadic groups pushing in from the steppes.
So the big question was, Did the local gene pool fundamentally change under all that pressure?
That's it. Did it buckle? Did it get replaced? Or did it adapt?
So the study's mission became clear. Map out how these two big external influences, the steppe to the north and the Near East to the south, shaped the genetics over time.
And not just at a broad population level, but looking at how things like trade routes, warfare, even the eventual adoption of Christianity affected who was moving where, sometimes down to specific individuals.
Which requires some serious data and methods. What do they work with?
The data set itself is impressive. They generated new genome-wide data from 230 ancient people.
Wow.
Yeah, the vast majority, 205, were from sites in Georgia, plus another 25 from Armenia, covering that whole 4,500-year span we're interested in.
And getting the timing right is crucial in archaeogenetics, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. You can't just rely on archaeological context sometimes. So they produced 85 new radiocarbon dates directly from the human remains they sampled.
Okay, so very precise dating.
Extremely precise. That lets you pinpoint when genetic changes were happening with much more confidence.
And what about the genetic analysis tools? What do they use?
They used a kind of standard but powerful archaeogenetic toolkit, starting with PCA, principal component analysis.
Right, that's the one that creates those plots showing how individuals relate to each other and to reference populations.
Exactly. It gives you that first visual overview, helps you spot anyone who looks genetically different, the outliers.
Then they dive deeper into the ancestry components.
Yes, using more sophisticated modeling techniques like QPADM and QPWave. Think of these as ways to statistically estimate the ancestry proportions.
Like figuring out what percentage came from steppe populations versus Anatolian farmers, for example?
Precisely. They can model ancestry based on older distal source populations or more recent proximal ones to quantify specific influxes over time. It's how they teased apart those northern and southern gene flows.
And they also looked at relatedness within the populations.
They analyzed patterns of haplotype sharing, looking at chunks of DNA shared between individuals, specifically IBD, identical by descent segments, and ROH, runs of homozygosity.
What does that tell you?
IBD helps you figure out how recently people shared ancestors, so you can spot close relatives or reconstruct recent population size changes. ROH, these long stretches of identical DNA on both chromosomes, can indicate things like recent inbreeding or small, isolated populations.
So putting it all together, large data set, precise dating, powerful analysis tools.
And that innovative step we talked about earlier, deliberately sampling 21 individuals who had artificially deformed skulls.
Right, directly linking the cultural practice to the genes.
Yeah, that integration is really what makes this study stand out.
Okay, let's get to the results then. What was the headline finding?
The biggest takeaway, confirming that initial paradox, was the remarkable genetic continuity. Over 90% of the people they sampled across that entire 4,500-year time frame had a genetic profile that largely matched the local populations from the Neolithic right up to the early Iron Age.
So the core local ancestry just persisted.
It really did. It shows incredible resilience of that local gene pool through millennia of pretty intense historical events.
But you said earlier it wasn't completely static. There were influxes of new ancestry.
Yes, absolutely. That long-term stability was punctuated by some key periods of admixture, especially starting in the Middle and Late Bronze Age.
Okay, where was this new ancestry coming from?
It came from two main directions, shaping the region in distinct ways. First, there was a clear signal from the North Eurasian steppe ancestry.
The EEHG-related ancestry we see across Europe and Asia.
Exactly. This is often linked to the arrival of mobile pastoralists, herders, and in many regions, it correlates with the spread of Indo-European languages.
Do we see specific genetic markers associated with that?
We do. For instance, the Y chromosome haplogroup R1BZ203, which is strongly associated with the Yamnaya culture from the steppe, appears in late Bronze Age Georgia in this dataset.
Interesting. Was this steppe influence uniform across the region?
That's the key point. It wasn't. The study found that this steppe ancestry component was significantly higher in the individuals from Armenia compared to those from Georgia, particularly during the Middle Late Bronze Age and the subsequent Iron Age.
So even back then, there was some genetic differentiation building up within the Southern Caucasus.
Seems like it, yeah. An early substructure.
And the second source of admixture, you said two directions.
The second source was from the south, from Anatolia and Iran. The model showed additional ancestry best represented by Chalcolithic populations from places like Arslan Tepe in Anatolia.
So during that Bronze Age transformation, you've got influences coming down from the steppe pastoralists and up from the established farming regions of the Near East.
Correct. two distinct streams mixing with that persistent local base.
Now let's talk about mobility.
Yeah.
We have this stable core, but people were still moving around, right? When did individual movement really ramp up?
It seems like mobility, especially long-distance individual movement, really peaked later on during late antiquity and the early Middle Ages, so roughly between 400 and 700 CE.
Oh, we'll see evidence for that.
They identified 14 individuals in the data set who were clear ancestry outliers. Their genetic profiles were dramatically different from the local population.
Where were they from?
All over the place, really. Some had ancestry pointing towards Central Asia, others towards Central Europe, others more broadly from Anatolia or the Levant.
Wow. And where are these individuals found mostly?
Predominantly in the major urban centers of the time, specifically sites like Mitskeda, which was the capital of ancient Iberia, and Samshfield.
So these cities were acting like magnets.
Exactly. Magnets for individual mobility.
Yeah.
Traders, soldiers, diplomats, artisans perhaps, coming from far and wide. But crucially, while these individuals show up, their numbers weren't enough to significantly shift the average genetic profile of the entire region.
That's a really important distinction between individual stories and population trends. Did this urban diversity affect local social structures, like marriage patterns?
It looks like it did. The genetic data, particularly the IBD and ROH analysis, revealed a pretty stark contrast between urban and rural sites.
How so?
In the urban centers like Mosqueda, they found high genetic diversity and generally low levels of recent shared ancestry among individuals.
What you'd expect in a large cosmopolitan city with people coming from all over.
Precisely. A more open mating network. But in the rural sites they sampled, like Nedziki and Kamarakavi, the picture was quite different.
More close-knit.
Very much so. They found significantly higher rates of consanguinity, meaning unions between relatively close relatives, like second cousins or closer, and also more short runs of homozygosity.
Which suggests?
It suggests these were likely smaller communities, probably practicing some form of partial endogamy, where marriage partners were predominantly chosen from within the local group, maybe based on strict cultural rules.
And this pattern was stable over time?
Remarkably stable, yes. The prevalence of close paternal relationships, say up to first or second cousins, seemed to hover around 25% to 30% in Georgia across millennia.
That points to very localized, stable community structures persisting alongside all the imperial drama and Longdingrid's mobility happening in the cities.
Exactly. A real mosaic of social organization.
Okay, let's circle back to the language question. We talked about that steppe ancestry arriving in the Bronze Age.
Mm-hmm.
Now, steppe ancestry is often linked to Indo-European languages. That seems to fit well for Armenian, which is an Indo-European language.
Right. The timing and source fit reasonably well with linguistic models for Proto-Armenian.
But Georgian, and the broader Kartvelian language family it belongs to, is not Indo-European. It's a distinct ancient language family endemic to the Caucasus.
Correct.
So if the steppe gene flow came into Georgia too, why didn't it bring an Indo-European language that replaced Kartvelian?
And that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It highlights a crucial point. Genetic ancestry doesn't automatically equal language transmission.
So the genes don't tell the whole story.
Not on their own, no.
Yeah.
The presence of steppe genetic markers in Georgia, even including those Y chromosomes, can't be used as a simple blanket explanation for language spread across the entire Southern Caucasus.
What could explain it then? Maybe the steppe influence in Georgia was different?
Several possibilities. Perhaps the number of steppe migrants entering Georgia was smaller than in Armenia. Or maybe it was predominantly male-driven migration, which sometimes has less linguistic impact than family-based movement.
Or maybe the local culture was just really strong.
That's another strong possibility. The existing Kur Araxes-derived population, the one with that resilient genetic core, might have had such a well-established cultural and linguistic structure that it essentially absorbed the newcomers linguistically, even while incorporating their genes.
Fascinating. Culture resisting the genetic tide, in a way.
Or rather, culture and genetics interacting in complex ways that we can't just read off a PCA plot.
Which brings us back very neatly to the artificial cranial deformation. This seems like a perfect case study of that complex interaction.
It really is. The genetics provided such a clear narrative here.
Remind us, the practice came in with outsiders.
Yes. The study confirmed this genetically. They found five individuals with ACD whose ancestry was clearly non-local, linking them to groups associated with the steppes in Central Asia, Alans, Sarmatians, maybe Huns. These individuals likely represent the people who introduced the practice.
Okay, the carriers.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't most of them.
No. That's the twist. The majority of the individuals with ACD16 out of the 21 they analyzed had typical local Southern Caucasus genetic ancestry.
So locals started doing it.
Exactly. They weren't migrants. They were genetically indistinguishable from their neighbors who didn't practice ACD. They adopted this foreign custom.
That's a huge finding for understanding cultural transmission.
It gets even better. The absolute clincher was the discovery of a mother and daughter pair, both buried with artificially deformed skulls and both with local ancestry.
Wow. So it was being passed down within local families.
Yes. Vertically transmitted from one generation to the next. It proves conclusively that ACD wasn't just something foreigners did. It became an integrated, locally practiced tradition, at least for some communities or families.
Culture adopted, not genetically imposed.
Precisely. A perfect example of cultural adoption trumping genetic replacement.
Thinking about those later periods, did the influence of the big empires, Rome, Persia, later Byzantium, and the Caliphate, leave a genetic trace beyond just those individual outliers in the cities?
It seems so. The analysis showed continued low-level gene flow from the Near East, specifically Anatolia and the Levant, right into historical times.
Consistent background mixing.
Yeah, and the researchers suggest that the shifting political control, the changing borders and allegiances under these large empires, likely influenced the direction and intensity of these mobility networks, subtly shaping the genetic landscape differently in Georgia versus Armenia over time.
So history impacting gene flow patterns. Makes sense. Were there any areas the study couldn't shed much light on? Any gaps left?
They did mention one significant area, Western Georgia.
Ancient cultures.
Exactly. That region bordering the Black Sea wasn't as well represented in the samples. They specifically noted that despite centuries of Greek colonization along the coast, documented historically and archaeologically.
Right, the Black Sea colonies.
The current genetic data didn't pick up a clear, significant signal of gene flow from the Aegean or Greece.
So either the genetic impact was minimal or maybe just not captured in these specific samples?
Could be either. It just means that the genetic history of Western Georgia, especially regarding potential connections across the Black Sea, remains an area needing more focused research with targeted sampling.
Okay, so pulling all this together for a take-home message, what's the core insight from this deep dive?
I think the central point is the incredible deep-rooted resilience of the Southern Caucasus gene pool. For nearly 5,000 years, through immense change and pressure, that core genetic structure largely persisted.
It bent, it absorbed, but it didn't break.
Exactly. It steadily incorporated outside influences from the north and south. It saw high levels of individual mobility, especially in cities, and people even adopted striking foreign cultural practices like ACD. But the fundamental genetic identity of the region endured.
Which really makes you think, doesn't it? What does that kind of deep genetic continuity actually mean for how we define local identity in the past?
Right. When cultural practices, maybe even languages in some cases, and certainly the ancestry of specific individuals, were clearly so fluid and adaptable over time.
It tells us that identity, community, being local, it's always been about much more than just shared DNA sequences.
A very important reminder from the ancient past.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating.
If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.